I'm going to focus on a slightly different methodology, which is wider field imaging for Lyman alpha searches as an alternative method of trying to find the highest redshift galaxies in AGN. And since Richard's done a lot of the motivation on the search for the reionization, the difference in this sort of methodology is that in general, because we're looking for the Lyman alpha galaxies rather than looking for continuum break objects, we can actually, we always find objects with Lyman alpha lines. And one of the things we want to do, besides trying to figure out if there is enough of them to ionize the gas, is that we really want to try and find out what we can infer about the IGM evolution from this. And of course, the fact that we have a Lyman alpha selected population, which is directly selected, means that we can test these things like are the luminosity functions similar at the various redshifts. But we can also test if the line widths and equivalent width distributions follow the pattern that we would expect from the theory. Now, I did want to do a little reprise on Zhaohui's talk this morning. Zhaohui gave a very beautiful presentation on the observations of the quasar. And of course, we all have seen this so often that it's tremendously familiar, right, in the thickening of the forest as we go to high redshift. And of course, the interpretation of this is possibly being neutrality beyond z equals 6 point something. One thing we should remember, though, right, is that even at lower redshifts, the forest is thickening very rapidly. And in particular, somewhere around z equals 4.5 is the point where voids actually start to become optically thick in the sense of tau becoming of order unity, right? And once that happens, of course, the transmission in the Lyman alpha forest drops like a rock, right? And because as these regions become thick, the whole structure of the forest spectrum disappears. And therefore, it's quite important to actually look both at the dispersion and at the evolution at lower redshifts in order to try and understand what's going on at z equals 6. And this just shows, the mean transmission in the Lyman alpha forest measured in 25 angstrom bins over the whole redshift range from about 2 to about 6, right? So a very large number of high-quality quasar spectra in this. You don't need to worry about little boxes. That's just objects that show Bell QSO signatures, right? They don't seem to be behaving very differently from ones that don't have them. But you can see in this that at any given redshift, there's a large spread in the transmission in these sort of bin sizes in the forest. And you can also see this point that I was trying to make, which is somewhere around 4.5. The voids start to become thick and the transmission starts to drop very, very rapidly. And it drops fairly smoothly all the way through to the z equals 6 object by the time, by which point you're having trouble measuring any transmission at all, of course, and only a small fraction of the objects actually show some level of transmission. And that's also true in the Lyman beta as well. Again, Zhaohui did such a nice presentation, it almost seems a pity to say this again. But here, what's plotted is just the data binned in groups of 6 measurements. And at each of the points, the solid boxes show the mean values. And the error bars actually show the spread in the bin over the 6 measurements. They're not 1 sigma errors. They're just the dispersion of the points in that bin. And you can see in this logarithmic plot, right, that in fact at all redshifts, there's essentially a fairly large spread in the transmissivity, right? And that persists through to the high redshift end. There's no dispute about the data points, right? The solid open symbols show the measurements by one group and the solid boxes the measurement by 20 at 20 Sangella at Hawaii. And the real question is what sort of interpretation you should put on this. The solid line actually shows a model with following the the prescription put forward by Patrick MacDonald and Jordi Miralda-Scudi, where you just simply put in an ionization parameter as a function of redshift and try and measure what the ionization parameter is in a particular lambda CDM model that actually fits the Lyman forest fairly well. And once you do that, of course, you can then, as Xiaohui showed this morning, simply measure the ionization parameter as a function of redshift, right? And then one can look at how that actually varies as a function of redshift. The interesting thing about this plot, right, is that it's been done on a number of bins in the 4.5, in the 4.5 range and the 4 to 5 range there. And you can see that each measurement is actually a bit different from the other one. In other words, there's a lot of spread in the values that you'd infer based on a particular number of measurements. So that in this 4 to 5 range, one can see that one could, by simply making one or two measurements, change the answer by factors of 2. And therefore, it raises the question when you look at the z equals 5 to 6 range, and you actually see a drop at 6, right? So, I mean, you might imagine that, in fact, there is actually an abrupt change between 5 and 6 there. You have to be very careful that that's not just the fact that you haven't actually very measured that many quasars, and that if you actually measured more, you'd actually pull that down and you get a smoother function. In fact, it's not hard to draw a fairly smooth function that might not actually be a fairly good representation of the evolution, right? So I think there is some reason for caution in all this, just in terms of the actual variance in these type of measurements. And also motivated a little bit by this discussion this morning, I hadn't really meant to put this spectrum, put this particular slide in, but in fact, it's quite interesting to just simply look at objects at roughly the same redshift and see how much difference there is, both in the region away from the quasar and also in the quasar region itself, right? And the top two panels there just show the spectra of the 1148 and 1048, which are two of the highest redshift objects. As Xiaohui discussed, right, there's actually differences in the transmission between one and the other. But that's also true down at z equals 5.7 or 5.8. Left-hand panel here shows 0836, right, which is at 5.8. Right, you can see there's a good deal of transmission in that object. The right-hand panel, which actually is a remarkable spectrum in some sense, because it's actually taken a resolution of 67,000, right, because it's a relatively bright object, and we now have a very red sensitivity instrument in the high-res spectrograph and Keck that can actually do this. And these things are just order breaks on the shell, right? But you can see you can actually get a fairly decent spectrum on this. There's actually no transmission, right, in this object, right, over this particular redshift range. So you can compare left and right there and see you can find objects which have high transmission and objects which have low transmission at 5.7 or 5.8, just as you can at 6.3 and 6.2. So I think one thing to keep in mind in all this is just how much difference there can be from line of sight to line of sight, and how I think it was Mike Norman made this point this morning, that you really need very, very large samples, right, before you can properly address the question of the transmission evolution, right, just because there is so much variance. So anyway, as Richard stressed, the big question is there hydrogen reionization around 6 and a bit, right? And one test of that is to try and decide whether there's a change in the Lyman alpha line properties of galaxies around this redshift boundary. In other words, do we start losing Lyman alpha galaxies, as Richard discussed? Do we see changes in their emission line properties because they're living in a neutral medium where the Lyman alpha line is cut away by the damping ring of the IGM? This also has a sense of reprise about it as well, right? Because the real key issue in this is, can we develop large, well-selected samples in the 5 to 7 redshift range? And 7, of course, is a natural boundary because we have to move into the IR at that point. We're only just getting the format IR detectors that we actually need to do that at this point, right? So I think in a few years, or perhaps even a couple of years, we'll start seeing talks which have large field Lyman alpha searches at z equals 7 or 8, but we can't do it quite yet, or not just yet. Right? So large samples of this sort are important because we also need to know how the structure formation and the ionization takes place. And one of the key issues in this, which Richard sort of alluded to, but which is a real problem with things like the UDF and good samples, is that there is an enormous amount of actual cosmic variance in these sort of systems, right? So that if one looks in a very small field, and the UDF is a tiny field, of course, even the goods regions are not very large fields, you're quite likely to put yourself down in a position where there aren't actually very many objects. And the most likely outcome of such a measurement is to underestimate things because you're going between the places where the objects actually are and you'll miss them, right? And then you'll undercount, essentially. So it is a concern. And in particular, when we're trying to predict whether the ionization at this redshift is produced by star-forming galaxies, then in fact, I think we really do need to worry about this quite a lot. We all know this, of course, right? I mean, the various techniques of finding things. The only one that Richard didn't really mention is targeted searches of X-ray or radio-selected objects. He hit the first two in considerable detail. But it is actually quite an intriguing way of trying to find high redshift objects by simply targeting, particularly the deep Chandra samples. And Hyman and Loeb, of course, predict that there should be, or could be, large numbers of such objects. So in fact, there have been fairly intensive efforts to find Z greater than 4 or 5 AGN in the X-ray selected samples. As I'll show you in a second, to the best of my knowledge, there only have been two X-ray selected AGN found beyond Z equals 5 at this point, and both of them were found by our group, right? So in fact, they really aren't very common, and they're quite hard to find. And as Xiaohui said this morning, they're almost certainly not responsible for the ionization of the universe. Let me just skip over that. We do need very, very large fields, right? Objects are very sparse at the brighter magnitudes, probably a few hundred per square degree at AB equals 25 and a half. Fields are highly correlated on sub-degree scales, right? So you really do need to do number of fields of near degree sizes, right, in order to be able to do a good job on this. Right, so this is an important point to emphasize, and I'll come back and just, I'll show you at the end what you actually get in these things. The Hawaii surveys have been going on for almost 20 years now, and it, as Richard said, every year or two we get a bigger telescope or a new instrument and we do it all a little better, right? I mean, so we've evolved from field sizes which in the 1980s were a few square arc minutes to field sizes which are a square degree. And as the telescopes have got bigger, our depths have got deeper and so on. The latest rendition of this is a major survey of six well-studied fields which have deep X-ray, radio, and submillimeter data. And it was motivated by the access of the Suprime camera on Subaru and the Mega Prime camera on CFHT. So these are square degree imagers. And in fact, Subaru, of course, is unique because it's the only 8-meter class telescope that actually has a wide field imager on it. So it's extremely, extremely powerful. Right? And the goal on this was to obtain HK prime and J near infrared images and a whole slew of optical bands, including two narrowband filters, which correspond to Z equals 6.6 and Z equals 5.7, right? And the total area is just under, it's just over a square degree, but it's approximately a square degree. And to take spectroscopy of all the X-ray and radio sources and all the Z equals 5.7 and 6.6 unread color selected objects in these, as well as obtaining huge numbers of spectroscopic identifications of field samples. There's actually a small area of one of the Suprime images. This was work done mostly by Peter Capek while he was a graduate student at Hawaii, right? He did most of the observations and reductions of these sort of data. So this is about a 225 square arc minute area around the HDF. For those of you who are very sharp-sighted, that's the HDF in there. This field is actually about a third of the actual total field around the HDF that's prime images. Right. And the reason I've shown it that way is because it also corresponds to the CDF North, which was the deepest X-ray image of the sky, right? It's a 2-megasecond image, of course. And this was done under the leadership of the group at Penn State, but with ourselves as collaborators. And you can see the enormous difference, of course, between an optical image and an X-ray image, since there are only 503 sources in the X-ray image, and about 60 or 70,000 in that 225 square minute area of sky of galaxies. That's even truer of submillimeter observations. It's a submillimeter image of the same area, right? And you see about a dozen really bright galaxies in that region. I won't say very much more about the submillimeter because, in fact, there are, as far as I know, apart from the observations of the quasars themselves, not a lot of high redshift identifications of submillimeter sources. Richard Mashotsky is going to talk more about the X-ray selected samples on Thursday. So I only wanted to make a very brief comment in this and to follow up on what Zhaohui said this morning. And this just shows the evolution of the number of sources as a function of X-ray luminosity over redshift. Right? So this is based on various Chandra samples. And the top curve shows what people would call X-ray sieverts. I mean, calling something X-ray sievert is a little silly, of course, I mean, but it's just a luminosity classification in this case. It's things with X-ray luminosities between 10 to the 43 and 10 to the 44, so sort of intermediate luminosity objects. Classic quasars, right, in the optical sense, correspond to X-ray luminosities just above about 10 to the 44 ergs per second. And the sort of objects that Zhaohui looks at with Sloan correspond to about minus 27, so that's way down, right? Very, very bright objects, right? The X-ray data, and Richard again will show this in much more detail, actually matches the 2DF surveys almost precisely, right, in the region where they overlap, right? So if you simply ask, do I see broadline AGN, right? Well, we see almost all broadline AGN. There's an almost perfect overlap between X-ray selected and optically selected broadline AGN. And the point that one wants to make from this is that in the various luminosity ranges, of course, the peak in the number counts, right, actually occurs at different redshifts. So for very luminous objects, it's around z equals 3. For sort of 10 to the 44 ergs per second objects, around z equals 2. But for lower luminosity objects, it's around z equals 1 or so. Right, possibly even a little below that. And then there's a fairly rapid drop off to z equals 0. For the present point, right, the fact that you actually don't detect very many X-ray selected AGN, and you would find them easily, right, because of their colors, right, you actually know that, in fact, the luminosity function is fairly flat, as Zhaohui showed this morning based on the optical data. And if you sort of connect the dots between the high luminosity end and the intermediate luminosity end, and also expand up to all the possible sources that you could put in from the X-ray samples, right? You find that there simply isn't enough ionizing photons from these sort of objects to do the ionization. So if AGN are doing this, they're below the X-ray luminosity selection criterion that we're using. In other words, they're down in the sort of 10 to the 40 few times 10 to the 42 ergs per second or lower luminosity range. They have to be quite faint, right? They're not the things up around 10 to the 44 or 10 to the 45 ergs per second that are dominant at intermediate redshifts. And you'd have to have a turn up in the luminosity function to do that. I'll skip over that. And I will mention one thing, which is it's not a minor effect, right? There are about two orders of magnitude too little red stream UV luminosity in these objects. Now, one thing which is sort of interesting, I think, if you're not that experienced on this, is ground-based observations with an 8-meter telescope, even through a narrowband filter, can get very close to HST observations in absolute sensitivity. Right? This is actually a comparison of the HDF region itself, right, in the 814W band, right, with an 8160 narrowband, and of course the wave bandpass on the second image there is only about 100 angstroms. At the very faintest level, there are objects that you can see in the Hubble Deep Field on the left-hand side that you can't see in the narrowband image on the right. But in general, the two images are actually very comparable in depth, and there only really is about a half magnitude or two-thirds of a magnitude difference in the actual depth. The only difference that you really have between the two is the resolution, of course. Subaru actually can give surprisingly good resolution, about a half arc second, or even sometimes 3 or 4 tenths of an arc second, right? So you can actually get remarkably high quality images, but you won't get the tenth of an arc second HST resolution. However, and this is one thing I think which Richard didn't actually stress, but which is true, even at the HST resolution, you can't be sure which objects you should select out based on compactness criteria. Unfortunately, a fair number of the high Z objects both in the dropout samples and in the Lyman alpha are quite compact. Right? And that's the reason there's so much confusion with the star population, right? It's because you can't simply go in and say, I'm only going to look at extended objects and throw all the rest of them out. Quite a fraction of the high redshift, the true high redshift galaxies are very compact, right? And therefore, the resolution doesn't necessarily help you that much because you're going to have to go in and observe all these objects anyway. So the ground-based data, in some sense, is a fairly direct way of doing this and not actually very much less sensitive. So what does one of these fields typically look like? Well, here I've shown an 8150 angstrom selected narrowband selected sample, and I've restricted myself to quite bright cut by these standards of about 24th magnitude. I mean, remember that the objects that we think we're looking for at 5 or 6 are actually around about 25 or 25.5, 26-ish magnitudes. What else does one see at this point? Most galaxies in a color selection technique like this, right, where the bottom plots the difference between the narrow band and a broader bandpass filter surrounding it, and the y-axis shows the color break of the object. What you see is you might naively expect that most galaxies should simply have I minus n of zero, right? In other words, they should have the same narrowband magnitudes they have the same as they have in continuum. In fact, what you see there in these fields where the number density in the solidly packed region there again is many thousands of objects, right? I mean, is actually a track that turns off to the right, as you go upwards. So you start seeing objects that look like emitters, right, at the faint end. The reason for that is that those are actually stars in the field, and as Richard mentioned, the molecular bands in those stars actually mimic an emission line feature in the narrowband, so they pull you off to the right as you go upwards. So you have to avoid the star track even in these emission line selected searches, right? You need to actually exclude objects which are very red in R minus Z and which are sort of curving into the emission line selected region. The second source of contaminants you have as well, right, which are always a worry in any of these surveys, are O3 and O2 emitters at lower redshift, right? I mean, and this just shows that in fact at these brighter magnitudes, there are oxygen 3 objects which extend up to very high equivalent widths, right? O2 doesn't usually go quite as far as that, but it's redder and therefore a more likely source of contamination because it's close to the Bama and 4,000 angstrom break region, and therefore you tend to see color breaks and those sort of objects. So you have to be fairly cautious that your samples are not contaminated by these type of objects. And there has been a tendency in the literature to actually go in and just take the filter selected objects and to assume that you can understand fairly well which ones are real and which ones are false, right? And I think that's very dangerous. I mean, I think the only samples that you should believe in this type of work are ones that are fully spectroscopically confirmed, right? You don't want to use non-spectroscopically confirmed samples because you are going to have contamination. Once you take the spectra, it's actually pretty obvious, right? Because in fact, at least at high resolution, you can easily separate out the O3 doublets, right, which are the top panel, the O2 doublets, right, which are very, very close together, but when you take a high resolution spectra, you can see them starting to split. And Lyman alpha objects, which have a very characteristic sort of shape, right, with the sharp edge at the blue end and the red wing to the longer wavelengths. So it's actually not that hard to do this. This is just an illustration of the fact that stars do tend to contaminate things, right? There are these molecular bandpasses, right, on either side of the narrow band that actually tend to mimic them up, which actually is why the star profile veers off in that way. But here's a typical example of what you actually get in the way of real objects, right? And now we're selecting things off to be emission line objects. We want them to be undetected in the R band or to have very red colors. And then we go in and spectroscopically identify all these. Some of them, again, turn out to be O3 emitters, some O2 emitters, which are shown by the diamonds and triangles. But a lot of them are actually genuine Lyman alpha emitters, right? So in this particular field, SSA22, there are 19 Lyman alpha emitters at 5.7 to a magnitude level of 25.1 in the narrow band. This actually, turns out more objects than the dropout techniques, and this is a figure that was sort of meant to illustrate this. The red tram lines show the spectral region where we'd actually detect Lyman alpha emitters in that narrow band in the Goods North field, right? So just one of the Goods areas. And there are about 6 Lyman alpha emitters in that region. It's about a quarter or a third of the field in the HDF. The open symbols show the objects found in the Goods South by the dropout techniques, and the solid symbols show the objects found by other techniques in the Goods North, as well as the dropout technique. So some of these are X-ray selected or chosen in various other ways. You can see there's about an equivalent number of total objects that have been found in the Goods region as you find simply by using the Lyman alpha technique in a much narrower redshift interval, right? So Lyman alpha techniques are actually very powerful at finding these sort of objects. I'll skip over that since we're, yes. One of the problems, as Richard emphasized, is that the narrowband techniques don't go that far down in Lyman alpha luminosity, right? Because even with these very, very deep observations, right, you're only going down to just below 10 to the 42 arcs per second in the Lyman alpha luminosity. And this is a comparison between the z equals 5.7 Lyman alpha luminosity function and the one that was measured at z equals 3.4, right? And you can see that the region of overlap isn't that large, but they're not actually terribly inconsistent with one another, certainly the factors of 2 or 3 level. Right? In other words, it's rising, at least to approximate the numbers that are seen at the lower luminosity. What may be of more interest is the continuum luminosity of the Lyman alpha selected objects. I mean, Lyman alpha luminosity is a horrible way to measure star formation rates. So what you actually want to do is move to the redder bandpasses and measure the continuum luminosity at that point. And that's what's been done here. We measure the absolute 1450 angstrom magnitude of the object. Solid boxes show the raw Lyman alpha selected luminosity function, and they've been compared with Chuck's determination on the Lyman break galaxies at z equals 3 or z equals 4. If you think back to Richard's diagram, right, about this, I mean, where he showed the luminosity function, essentially he was saying it's dropped by about a factor of 5 or 6 at this point. If that is the case, then the Lyman alpha selected galaxies have detected the entire luminosity function, right at this position, because in fact the drop between the Stydell luminosity function and the Rolle-Lyman alpha selected luminosity function is a factor, is only about a factor of 5, right? So you really have two options here, I think, right? One is to say, well, Lyman alpha selection isn't detecting all the galaxies. There's some that don't have Lyman alpha emission, and therefore you want to correct this upwards, in which case the star formation rate is higher than the one that Richard showed you. I mean, the alternative is to say, well, I believe that the Lyman alpha, that all of the galaxies at this redshift have strong enough Lyman alpha emission lines to be in this sample, in which case that factor of 5 correction is correct, but all of the objects are Lyman alpha emitters. Right? So I think it probably emphasizes the fact that there really are very significant uncertainties in this at this point. The number of Lyman alpha selected galaxies is actually beginning to rise very rapidly. Right? There are about 33 galaxies known in the 5.7 range by our own group, right? And probably a comparable number from various Japanese and American groups. And even more importantly, at 6.6, there now are starting to be what we would call substantial galaxies, which is there are now 9 galaxies detected in the Abel 370 and HDF fields. One of the things that might strike you about this, I might go 2 or 3 minutes over if it's okay. There are nine in Abel 370, and there are 0 in the HDF, right? And you might worry that there's actually more field-to-field variation in there than you would take, than you would like, and that actually possibly there's some real variation between fields, which might argue there's something odd going on in the sense of large-scale changes in the opacity or something like that. These are super-sized fields. One of the things which is striking about this is that Taniguchi, in a paper that just came out in AstroPH, describes the similar 6.6 sample in the Subaru deep field, and there again they detect a fair number of objects. In fact, one of the things which was quite perturbing this initially is we did the HDF field about a year and a half ago, and we didn't find any very compelling objects in it, and we were quite baffled by this. And then the Japanese, of course, said, oh, we've detected lots of objects in the Subaru deep field, right? So we were getting very confused at that point. And then, of course, we detected a large number of them in the Abel 370 field, right? In any event, there probably are now somewhere in the order of 20 or 25 galaxies in the 6.5 range, enough to construct a very, very crude luminosity function. And this just shows the comparison between the 5.7 Lyman alpha luminosity function and 6.6 luminosity function, which is shown by the red symbols on there. In essence, as far as we can tell, there is no real difference in the luminosity function at 5.7 and at 6.6. There really hasn't been very much of a change. Now, the uncertainties in this are large enough that I suspect that you could move these things around by factors of 2 or maybe even 3, right? But at least at that level, the luminosity function is invariant, right? I'll skip over the star formation rate since we sort of discussed this already. And I did want to make at least this one last point. This actually shows the 5.7 Lyman alpha emitters in the SSA22 field, which is on the left, and then the HDF on the right. You can see already, right, that they sort of occur in patches and regions, right? And in fact, if you split this by actual redshift, so we just divide the band into 2 bits, right? All of these lie in one part of the redshift range and all the other ones lie in the other, right? And similarly, if we do the same thing on the HDF, right? These all lie in the bottom redshift range and the other ones lie in the upper redshift range. So there's actually considerable amounts of filamentary structure in these things, right? And indeed, one of the sort of fascinating things to me actually is as you go on doing this, right, you actually may be able to map the whole filamentary structure in the 6.5 or 5.7 range, and actually look at the tomography of the space distribution of the galaxies, which I think would be quite dramatic. We haven't quite got there yet. And I did want to make one final remark, right, which is there's no difference in the equivalent width distribution, and there's no difference in the shape of the lines between 6.6 and 5.7. Right, I don't really have time to go through this, unfortunately, but essentially, the width of the line, the equivalent width distribution, in this classical shape is actually similar. And the one at the top is 6.6, and the one at the bottom is 5.7. And if you can distinguish it, it'll be better than I am at this, right? So in fact, if there is substantial neutrality at 6.5, it certainly isn't showing any signatures in objects at this Lyman alpha luminosity. And the final caveat in this, and then I'll stop, is the one that Richard presented, which is these are probably relatively high luminosity objects, and therefore, as Piero and Zolt and various other people pointed out, they may be able to protect themselves to some extent by their H2 region. However, they're not actually that luminous, and it's very marginal whether they can really successfully and safely do that, right? And therefore, you'd certainly expect, two or three times less in the equivalent widths, and you don't see that. And I'll stop.
Any questions for Len? Then Richard.
Well, I think this for some reason, this observation that the Nernst function doesn't change, it's interpreted as evidence against ionization, where I always thought it was actually again evidence for ionization in redshift 6, because those are sources. And so your sources of ionizing radiation actually doesn't change very fast from between, say, 6.6 and 5.7. Whereas the forest does change very fast. And it's not really that the tau gets very large, it's how fast it changes. And it's at least from Sloman data, it does appear that there is sort of a characteristic scale there, which is very short time scale. And because sources don't change that fast, nothing changes in the universe, nothing can change that fast except this overlap of H2 regions. The only thing which can give you this very short characteristic time scale at roughly these redshifts. So that was sort of the reason for giving this argument that ionization happened, sort of ended, whatever people used to call ionization, at 6. And so in some sense, from my point of view, this observations of Lyman alpha emitters actually support this idea, because your source population doesn't change.
Yeah.
So your source function on the right-hand side of ionization equation doesn't change, but the left-hand side changes fast.
I take your point entirely, right? And I mean, I think there's various ways of looking at this as sort of half full or half empty, right? Depending on the point of view that you actually want to take. I mean, the half full would be this kind of variation, right, in things, right? These large scale field variations would sort of argue that maybe you're starting to see percolation in the ionization. I think the point that you're trying to make, right, that there's a fast decrease in the ionization parameter you measure from the forest versus a slow decrease in the star formation rate that you're actually seeing in the samples, I think is one that's very vulnerable to the observations, unfortunately. And I think it's vulnerable just because of the point I was trying to make, right, which is I don't think you're actually averaging over enough lines of sight at the minute to really be very secure that that drop is as fast as you think it is, or as abrupt. And I think the reason for that is I think we're probably slightly overestimating the 5.5 to 6 ionization parameter, and therefore we're overinterpreting the size of the break relative to the 6 to 6.5 stuff, right? And once you actually had a better measurement than that, it might actually be rather smoother, right? And in particular, in all the diagrams that I showed, things like 0002, right, aren't in there, despite the fact it's a very dark quasar, just as an example. I think similarly with the Lyman alpha emitters, right, I mean, you could imagine that there's still factors of 2 flying around in there, right? I mean, possibly even factors of 3, and therefore that the star formation rates could be somewhat changing, right? Also, as you well know, right? I mean, once you start to get into the radio transfer problems, right? I mean, you know, the thing actually does some. I mean, the ionization rate you're measuring from the quasars may not be a really very good reflection of the star formation rate in the galaxies, right? So, I mean, there's all sorts of subtleties in this, I think. But I take your point, right? I mean, I wouldn't care to hazard my life on the answer to this question.
Clearly, we need more lines of sight. Right? That's a very, very simple observation.
This question of the interplay between the evolution of the dropouts and the evolution of the Lyman alpha emitters is quite interesting. It's certainly possible that, say, between a redshift 3 and 6, that the differential evolution in the luminosity function for the dropouts and the Lyman alpha emitters amongst them is changing in some complicated way. But it would be, as you point out, it would be very embarrassing if the factor of 6 drop in the dropouts between 3 and 6 then implied that all of the objects in the dropout sample would have to be Lyman alpha emitters, you know, for the two to be consistent. So the question is, in your Lyman alpha emission selected sample, do you have deep enough continuum measurements to address what fraction of the Lyman alpha emitters are, you know, seen in the continuum?
I mean, the observations are deep enough so that most of the Lyman alpha emitters are detected in the continuum, which is where I got the continuum luminosity function
from. Oh, I thought you deduced that independently.
Well, but that's based on the... Let's go back. So, yeah, well, actually, this is probably as good a place to look as any, right? I mean, you can see on there, these are in the Goods region, of course, right? So the Z magnitudes measured here are actually in the Goods data, right? So the 9100 long path or whatever. And what you can see is that the continuum magnitudes on the Lyman alpha selected object, except for one of them, which is very faint, right, aren't actually that different from the ones being picked out in the dropout techniques. They're a little bit, I mean, they're maybe just a little bit fainter or just at the edge of the selection criteria in the dropout technique. Right, so I think that the things which are just falling out at the edge of the drop samples, right, but they're not very much fainter in the continuum magnitudes than the drop samples, right? And I think as regards your point, I mean, I think it wouldn't be that embarrassing if it turned out that there's a much higher prevalence of Lyman alpha emission at high redshift. I mean, there's less dust, the galaxies are more dynamically disturbed, they're smaller, right? I mean, they're more likely to have channels by which the Lyman alpha can rattle out of the galaxy. But I think it is also true that there are a number of drop objects in the fields where one can't see Lyman alpha emission, where they're extended, so they're almost certainly not stars. Right, and therefore, I don't think you're selecting all of the objects of the Lyman alpha technique that you see in the dropout technique. So I think there are these factors of two or three flying around. Right, and I think, you know, if you think back to the film entry diagram, again, it's just if you pop yourself down on some random region of sky, right? I mean, you're not necessarily going to count things terribly accurately. I mean, the point you made.
There is one point which is often neglected, and that's the fact that these galaxies cluster. And therefore, you should not calculate the ionized H2 region around a galaxy like that in order to figure out whether it can allow transmission or not, because there is a cluster of fainter sources around it that help it. And in fact, even those bright galaxies you showed us have clustering in their distribution on the sky. And so the region around such a galaxy would be ionized not by the galaxy itself, but by a group of galaxies, some of which you don't see because they're too faint. And when you do the calculation, you actually find that there is no problem. At redshift 6.5, the H2 regions around these galaxies, if you just take a reasonable luminosity function of galaxies and clustering properties, you should expect the region to be big enough to allow transmission of the Lyman alpha line.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, that's true. I mean, there are possibilities of self-protection, right? And that's always an issue. Well, I think... Yeah, exactly, right? You also need to make assumptions about the luminosity function as well, right? I mean, which may or not be true, right? I mean, and where the star formation is actually occurring and all sorts of other things. So there are all sorts of positive hidden assumptions in this. I mean, so I think, I mean, your point is generically, I mean, well taken, right, in the sense I think protection is possible, right, and therefore one can't take this as, no, you couldn't have neutrality at the 6.5, right? I mean, it's just, in as far as we can make a measurement, right, doesn't change.
Hey, Len, I agree with your point that you need to look at a lot of quasars to get the transmission accurately, particularly at high Z. All the way down to redshift 2, when we measured the transmission in a sample of 77 objects, the variation from object to object is huge. You know, standard deviation is about half of the mean.
Yeah.
So I think you're exactly right on that point.
Yeah.
I just wondered what the typical velocity width of that red wing was now that you have say, 40 Lyman alpha profiles, and I realize most of the spectra are not that high quality, but can you say anything about whether there's any variation?
They really are fairly high quality, right? I mean, and among other things, you can actually, you can also stack them, of course, right?
Sure.
Just to see what the average
sure.
is.
Sure, so is there any variation from the mean?
You have to do the deconvolution, so to speak, right? I mean, because you know you're looking at a truncated emission line. And indeed, one answer to Avi's question, of course, is you do know you're looking at a truncated emission line because the shape is very characteristic of a heavily truncated emission line, right? If you do that, right, and sort of measure the velocity dispersion, typically there are a couple hundred kilometers a second, 150, something like that. I'm not sure that actually tells you very much, right, unfortunately, because, of course, it's a measure of the scattering processes that allow the Lyman alpha to get out of the parent line. So I don't think you go in there and say that's the velocity dispersion of the galaxy. It's the broadening of the Lyman alpha line as it comes out of the galaxy. And it's moderately broad. Certainly resolvable at the Deimos resolution quite easily. So these tails, essentially, you can see that they have shape and structure and things like that. And indeed, the classic example of this, if I can just show it, since I didn't actually get to that, is this thing, right, which is the lensed object in ABEL 370, right? So here we can actually also spatially resolve the line, right? And there's about four independent positions across this thing, and you can actually see the profile, right? And you can also see that at the bottom end of this, actually it's moved off the cutoff, right, and actually has, so that the sharp cutoff is, you know, at zero there, right? And the lowest, the spatial resolution element, is actually symmetric, right? It's only asymmetric in the other three spatial profiles, right? So you can actually see the sharp cutoff in this object. And as I said, the velocity profile in this, and you can see it on here, is of order 100 to 200 kilometers a second.
Just as a follow-up, I would be very hesitant about interpreting the asymmetries in the Lyman alpha line as a constraint on ready-to-transfer effects in the IGM, because you see exactly the same kind of asymmetric Lyman alpha profiles even in starbursts at zero redshift. And in those cases, it's clear that the missing flux on the blue side of the profile is just absorption in a galactic wind. So Chuck may say something about this in his talk, but these asymmetric Lyman alpha profiles are generic in Lyman bright galaxies at redshift 3, and you see them at redshift 0.
They're not so generic in the Z equals 3 Lyman alpha emission line selected samples. I mean, the lines at Z equals 3 are actually more symmetric than the lines at 5.7, right? So while I take your point, I'm not sure for these particular objects it's so true, and the difference may just be in the size and luminosity of the objects. I mean, what you say is certainly true, right? I mean, when you make a structure like that, you're going to self-absorb in particular ways and produce asymmetric structures. I just think it may be a bigger effect than that, at these sort of luminosities.
Just to follow up on Avi's point, even if you don't have faint sources, it's the fact that you got more or less same profile, actually 5.7 and 6.5, is not inconsistent with the neutral fraction equal to 0.1, for example, at redshift 6.5. Now, if x is 1, it will make a big difference. But if it's 0.1, that's low enough such that the Strugman sphere sort of is quite far away, has no effect on the suppression on the Lyman alpha line.
Yeah, I think that point is well taken and true, right? I mean, that is to say, it is a function of the degree of neutrality. It is a function of the degree of clustering. It's a function of the radiative transfer. It's a function of the luminosity function, right? I mean, so that a detailed interpretation or trying to make a robust conclusion from this isn't really possible, right? And I wouldn't care to do so, and I'm not doing so, right? But I do think it is an interesting piece of information that you have, right, that actually can go into the modeling and actually at least provide some constraint.
Okay, one last question. Okay, it's very simple. I came, looking at the program, I came hoping to hear a resolution of the two points of view about the transmission through the Lyman alpha forest rapidly changing just below redshift of 6, so that I would know whether that was a valid argument for the end of reionization
Well, I think what, maybe I shouldn't.
Sorry, it's not just a question to you. I sort of want to hear, you know, Fawn, and I don't.
I mean, I think one of the things I would say is, I mean, Zhang's talk this morning was really excellent, right? And I think they well recognize the same problems that I was talking about, right? And I think it's an uncertain question, right? And I think that was the answer Zhaohui gave this morning, right? Which is, it's not a secure result.
What is the discrepancy? The uncertainty aside, why do you disagree with
it? It's simply, in fact, we don't, I think, at this point, right? I mean, I wouldn't have disagreed with anything that Zhaohui said this morning, right? I mean, I think there's an open question about how much interpretation to put onto that break.
Okay, that wasn't a short question.
that is the answer, Paul. There are too few lines, and therefore the smoothness of that distribution is not secure.
Okay, so let me turn.